Welcome to the fourth episode of the Conversation Democracy 2025 podcast on political trust in times of COVID-19, produced by our digital partner, Content Group. This is Mark Evans, the co-host of the podcast series with Michelle Grattan and Director of Democracy 2025. Today, we're going to focus on the topic, after the crisis, what lessons can we draw from the management of COVID-19 for the recovery process? Here I'll begin by presenting the very latest findings from a comparative survey that we conducted in May and June in Australia, Italy, the UK and the US on political trust and democracy in times of coronavirus. Now, in this survey, we investigated whether public attitudes towards democratic institutions and practices had changed during the pandemic. And you can find the first of three reports on the findings on the Democracy 2025 website at democracy2025.gov.au. We'll then open up to a panel discussion on the implications of the findings for the recovery process with two eminent panelists. First, we have the irrepressible Norman Swan, presenter of ABC Radio National's health report and physician. And according to informal polling and also the focus groups that we conducted during the Eden Monaro by-election, the most trusted messenger of COVID-19 advice in Australia. And I've even put on my Andy Murray tennis shirt to celebrate Norman's appearance. And second, we have the erudite Professor Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute at the Australian National University, Chief Political Correspondent and National Affairs Editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and the Canberra Times for 6 years, and the voice of reason on the ABC's Insiders programme. A very warm welcome to you both. Now, let me begin by presenting the high-level findings from the survey. First, on levels of political trust, we found that political trust has increased significantly in Australia in times of coronavirus and compares extremely strongly with Italy, the UK, and the US. So for the first time in over a decade, Australians are exhibiting relatively high levels of political trust in federal government. So that's from 29% to 54% over the period. And also the Australian Public Service from 38 to 54%. Australians have the highest level of confidence in defence and law and order organisations, such as the Army at 78%, the police 75%, and the courts. And levels of trust are also high in health services, 77%, cultural institutions such as museums at 70%, and universities at 61%, although that percentage has gone down a little bit over the period. Australians continue to have very low levels of trust in social media, from 20 to 19% over the period, but trust in television, radio, and newsprint have all increased. And of course, Australians also continue to exhibit high levels of trust in scientists and experts, at 77%. On public perceptions of the effectiveness of COVID-19 management and leadership, Prime Minister Scott Morrison is perceived to be performing strongly on most measures of COVID-19 management and leadership by a significant majority of Australians. Indeed, he possesses the strongest performance measures in our four-country sample. There is also strong support for the Prime Minister's handling of COVID-19 across the Federation. Queenslanders at 76% are the most appreciative, and South Australians the least appreciative. But even here, their approval rating is at 62%. In contrast, the general assessment of the handling of the crisis by state and territory leaders is much lower. But they are deemed to be performing much better in terms of listening to experts and caring about citizens. On average, only 37% of Australians think their state premier or chief minister is handling the coronavirus situation well. This contrasts with 71% approving the work of the former chief medical officer, Brendan Murphy. And obviously, this again demonstrates the importance that Australians now attach to evidence-based decision-making. Mark McGowan from Western Australia at 49% is the highest performing state premier, followed by South Australia's Stephen Marshall at 44%. The poorest rated state premier is Queensland's Anastasia Palaszczuk at 28%, followed by New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian at 28% and 34%. Now, this suggests that in Australia, the politics of national unity or rallying around the flag has come to the fore in times of crisis. And this has penalised states or territories seen to be pursuing self-interest. On compliance with COVID-19 measures, most Australians are complying with the key measures, but are marginally less compliant across the range of interventions than their counterparts in the UK and Italy, but equal with the US. This is likely to be lower due to perceptions of the risk of infection, given the significant differences in the number of COVID-19 fatalities, although of course this is starting to shift. Ironically, Victorians are the most compliant with anti-COVID-19 measures, somewhat ironic observation given the recent upsurge in cases in Victoria, and the ACT, Tasmania and Northern Territory are the least compliant. Again, this is in line with the low level of reported cases in these states and territories, and by implication, lower public perception of the risk of infection. We then asked our sample whether Australia has the resilience to meet the challenge of post-COVID-19 recovery. Now, although a significant majority of Australians, at 60%, expect COVID-19 to have a high or very high level of financial threat for them and their families, they are far less worried than their counterparts in Italy, the UK and the US about the threat COVID-19 poses to the country, to them personally, or to their jobs or business. But the majority of Australians are pessimistic about Australia's short-term economic prospects, with close to a majority expecting the economy to get worse over the next 12 months. And this percentage is slightly lower in the US, but much higher in the UK and Italy. Nonetheless, Australians remain confident that Australia will bounce back from COVID-19, with most believing that Australia is more resilient than most other countries, at 72%, and 9% seeing Australia as best in the world. However, we can also see that women, young people, Labour voters, and those on lower incomes with lower levels of qualifications are the most pessimistic on all of these confidence measures. Finally, we also assessed whether views about democracy had changed. And in general, there is overwhelming support for representative democracy, but with a focus on making the representative system of government more representative, accountable, and responsive to the citizenry, underpinned by a new politics which is cleaner, collaborative, and evidence-based. Now, let me hand over to Michelle to open up with some questions to our panel.
Thanks, Mark. Norman, I'll start with you and go to the personal. How has COVID-19 changed your life, perhaps apart from making it frantically busy at work?
I was going to say that's the main thing. Changed my life. It's kind of curious. It's a tragic event, but it's a curious event. It's that I've always been interested in pandemics. I made a four-part series for Channel 4 many years ago, and I never actually thought I'd see this in my lifetime, and that's had a profound effect. I remember being chilled near the beginning of the pandemic, being at probably one of the last dinners out with friends, and looking around the table thinking, you haven't got a clue what's about to happen, knowing that this hasn't happened since 1918. And so I suppose what it's given to me is a window into history. And how, plus ça change, plus les mêmes choses, is just that window into history that we are behaving now in similar ways that we've done since the plague years in the 14th and 15th centuries. And to see that before your eyes with the trappings of the 21st century world is extraordinary. I think that's going to be a very lasting effect for me, the continuity of human behavior and civilization.
And Mark, what about the life of an academic and a journalist? Because university life has certainly transformed.
Yeah, well, that's right, Michelle. Thanks for the question. I'm sitting here in my office in the ANU at the moment, but the truth is I've hardly been on the campus for most of the last 6 months or 5 months or so. It's been really quite an extraordinary experience for everyone. And having not really been at the university that long, I've been here about 18 months all up. It's a fair chunk of my time, in my sort of post press gallery career. Now, as you know, I have this kind of this dual role of still doing quite a lot of political coverage, analysis, and commentary, as well as my role now at the university. Or this is sort of is part of my role at the university, and it's had to. You know, change. In a journalistic sense, and you would experience this as well, Michelle, everything is about COVID these days. I mean, there are sort of no other stories. There are things that come and go, but this is the story of the year, of the age, and other stories are sort of obliterated really by it. If we think about sports rorts, for example, that was running as a strong story, even the bushfires, which was running as a very strong story at the start of the year, for very good reasons in terms of its weight, has really just been sort of obliterated by this. So it's been from a personal point of view, quite an experience to watch this. I'm intrigued by Norman's point about watching history repeat as well, or at least having that window into history and getting a sense of what it was like in the past. Because I think we are learning quite a lot about, I guess, the sort of the psychology of societies, but also the psychologies of individuals within them. You know, we take, if we look at this from a sort of a public health perspective, you know, take something like smoking. Why do people smoke when, or have they historically smoked when it was known to be harmful? And one of the reasons is because we have this amazing ability to compartmentalize. Whatever danger is associated with it is down the track a long way, so the urgency factor is not there. And there's also this kind of human exceptionalism that we all have. You know, whatever's going on, even though it's going on right now in the case of coronavirus, probably won't affect me. And you see this in the behavior of a lot of people. So it's been really interesting trying to sort of cover this story and to look at the performance of governments and to look at the way they're trying to message here in the context of these human frailties, these very sort of human characteristics.
Norman, we're all obsessed, of course, with the present, quite naturally, but what do you think are the big changes that will remain with us post-COVID-19?
Well, I'm hoping what will remain with us is a renewed interest in science. So I think we've, in a very short space of time, my impression is that a very significant percentage of the Australian population has become quite literate. They talk about epidemic curves. They talk about R values. They talk about antibodies and T cells. I mean, the literacy, the science literacy has gone up. And I hope that lasts because I think that people are seeing the benefits of science and relying on it and hoping that science will deliver. Kind of, so I think that that's there. I think that in politics, I think a lot of people are hoping that there's a degree of bipartisanship that might emerge. I think they're going to be disappointed, but you never know. You know, just as we record this coronacast, the Prime Minister's in battle with the Labour Party over industrial relations legislation, allegedly by the Labour Party, by stealth, and whether you actually use this opportunity undercover to get through legislation otherwise there. And I think that the government in power will soon see a loss of trust in that. But I think that people are hoping for bipartisanship because they've seen it in action and hope that it moves forward. In healthcare, we've got more online care. We've got probably a bit more efficiency going on in healthcare. We've got there's going to be radical changes, I think, over time to general practice. I think that there'll be an unfortunate consequence as there's been a heavy focus on hospitals rather than on general practice, and there's going to be a bit of important communication and incentivizing for people to realize that general practice is the core of the system. So there's lots and lots of things that people hope will change, I suspect will not, and some which will and be lasting.
Mark, the political scientists talk about wicked problems in policy terms, and this has been a wicked problem if we've ever seen one, and some particular approaches have been taken to dealing with it. Do you expect any changes to the way we do public policy in the future as a result of what we're going through now?
Look, I think there'll probably be a number of kind of backroom sort of mechanical changes in the way public policy is done. I think the public service will be operating differently, for example. There's some of the obvious things. I think that's going to be economy-wide. I mean, we've all had a crash course in the sort of technology we're using right now to record this podcast of people being in distributed locations and communicating differently. And it's interesting that that's been, it's almost like a case of punctuated equilibrium. There's been a sudden shock that has just forced us all to suddenly become literate in technologies that have actually been around for a little while now, but for which there was no huge take up. I mean, there are obviously some people were using Zoom and so forth before this crisis, but this has come along and basically said, well, you can't do it any other way. You can't get on a plane and go to that meeting, and you can't even go into work and have that meeting in the boardroom. You need to be doing it via this. So I think that's a small window into the change in the way we interact, but I think it's going to have significant implications for the way we think about a whole lot of things, including who we consult with, because we could literally be sitting here now as we record this with someone sitting in Berlin or Jakarta or anywhere else. They don't need to be, if they don't need to be in the same room, they don't need to be in the same city or even in the same country. So that's one thing. But just going back to Norman's point about trust and about, you know, science, about the valuing of expertise, and about hopes that Mark Evans and I have written about for a greater level of cooperation in decision-making. I'm sort of still optimistic about that, but I do note, and as Mark would agree, I'm sure, that adversarialism is hardwired into our system. I mean, we actually have a government and opposition type model, and it's a binary system. The only way the opposition can become the government is by defeating the government, not necessarily by cooperating with it. And whilst there has always been some overlap in those two concepts, and that's been really shown quite dramatically in this, the overlap itself has been the thing people have embraced, the idea that the opposition and the government are essentially on the same page. I think it's going to be sorely tested the longer we go through this. I'll just say two quick things, though. You think about wage subsidies, which are probably the major sort of economic policy decision the government's taken, the JobKeeper program. That was originally suggested by Labor and opposed by the government, not in exactly that form or with that name, but the concept of wage subsidies was. So similarly, I think that there's been some, that's a good example really of where we see that overlap working and people have embraced that. It's going to be interesting to see whether that same sort of transition will occur with say this burgeoning debate now between the suppression school and the eradication school, because I think that's an area where there is a sort of a pulling apart, and it'll be interesting to see if there can be any consensus emerge on that question.
Mark, I just want to go back to Mark Evans' introduction and his numbers on trust and support for political leaders, and we have seen quite strong support compared to the past in this survey and others. But to what extent is that fragile? I'm thinking particularly of Dan Andrews, and we have seen some other polling about in the last very few days suggesting that people's faith in him has fallen in light of what's happened in Victoria. Do you think that this level of trust in the leaders is very much related to their particular performance in this crisis and will just peel off? For example, if the national economy, its recovery bogs down, then Scott Morrison's numbers will decline correspondingly.
In short, yes, I do think that these numbers are quite fragile. There's support for pretty much, in fact, if you look right across the world, there's support for just about every government, save for those who have, you know, catastrophically stuffed it up and done so in a very obvious way. But pretty much there has been a kind of a, you know, sort of everyone getting into the peloton behind the leader type approach in most countries because it's the only way through. And you get that with common enemies. You get that in times of war as well. And we have a common enemy here, which is this virus. It's a challenge that affects everyone. And so there is a sense of needing to get behind it, you know, dialing down the normal partisanship that is associated with issues which lose their importance compared to this. But we've seen it even in other cases. You know, I'm thinking of a former Queensland Premier whose name is momentarily escapes me, Anna Bly. She was very popular, for example, in handling floods, but that popularity didn't last very long. So I think if this crisis gets worse in Victoria and it's sheeted home, as it seems to be, to stuff-ups in the hotel quarantine system for which the state government was responsible, I think that is a very tough situation. And going to your final point, Michelle, I think if the economy bogs down further and this goes on, and particularly if we find ourselves going back into other state lockdowns, for instance, if it happens in New South Wales, and this has a, you know, debilitating effect on the economy, then the whole argument about whether we should have been in an eradication strategy and should have stayed there longer. Remember when Scott Morrison was saying, whatever we do, we have to do for 6 months? And then we didn't do it for anything like 6 months. And perhaps that's actually one of the lessons of all of this. So voters may start to take a dimmer view if things get dire.
So I find it really interesting that you got such a disparity between the federal, you know, at a federal level between Scott Morrison, Brendan Murphy, and at state level with the state premiers. Because in fact, my reading, you know, having followed this through, is the heroes of COVID-19 pandemic in Australia have actually not been the federal government. I mean, everybody's done a great job, but the real heroes have actually been the state premiers. They've stepped up to the plate. Because the Commonwealth doesn't run anything. They feed money into the system. They create macroeconomic solutions to what's been a devastating economic catastrophe. But the reality is the people who do stuff is always the states. They carry the can. And they've done the job incredibly well. You've got most states and territories have got zero community spread. And and until you had the hotel quarantine problem, Victoria and New South Wales were doing pretty well. And that's state governments. It's almost nothing to do with the federal government. And yet they haven't been given credit for it. And I think it's because it's been very easy at a federal level to talk in generalities, come up with some good news, put some money into the system, and speak overall and talk about the borders, whereas it's the state premiers who've actually had to give the bad news. And it looks as though, if it continues like this, they'll pay the price politically and very unfairly in many ways.
Interesting point. Can I now hand back to Mark?
Yeah, so, I mean, look, there also, Norman, seems to be this kind of rally around the flag sort of patriotism dimension to that as well. So if state premiers or chief ministers are seen to be articulating any form of self-interest at this conjuncture, it works against them. But of course, when they go into the recovery process and there's going to be a massive contestation over resources, you start to see the waning of the rally round the flag approach, which may well impact on trust. So thinking about the recovery process now, Norman, what lessons do you think could be drawn from the management of COVID-19 for the recovery process? What are the good lessons that can be taken forward?
Well, so it's the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's mostly good because we're just globally we're a success story. So it's mostly good. However, you're seeing the weaknesses in the system now because as we record this coronacast, we've just seen 428 new cases in Victoria, and the so what's in terms of recovery? I think that Australians have shown resilience. I think that we've shown a strong sense of community. Yeah, you can take pictures of people on Bondi Beach or doing the wrong thing in bars in Victoria, but by and large, you cannot control an epidemic by government fiat. It's got to be communities do it, and communities have rallied around. We had 80% compliance with the lockdown back in March. And that's what turned it around, was that 80% compliance. And it happened in all states and territories with varying levels of the whip. And so I think that community, that sense of community is going to be a very important part of our resilience moving forward. We've got this debate going on now about there's a problem here, which is that in some ways we had it easy at the beginning. They did the right thing. We closed down the borders. That vastly reduced the burden of infection in Australia. And we didn't have a huge amount of community transmission. And they really used the lockdown to build up capacity for testing and contact tracing. So they did the right thing there. But I think that the premiers and the prime minister talk about community being lulled into a false sense of security. I actually think government was lulled into a false sense of security, and they gave themselves a lap of honour and a herogram when in fact they didn't necessarily deserve it because they weren't equipped for a community transmission. They were at state level and a public health level, but not politically. And one of the things that have been shown up is the weakness of advice at a federal level. They've been slow on masks, and slow on this notion of aerosols, which is very important to community spread. And then there's this kind of sterile debate, which I'll take some responsibility for since I've covered it, on eradication versus suppression. And we're using stupid words here. I mean, just to be blunt, they're stupid words because we're more similar than we are apart. We should just get rid of these words because eradication confuses people because we'll never eradicate this virus. Suppression is a mad word to be using here because it condemns us to future outbreaks and constantly chasing our tail. What we should be talking about is zero spread. And we can get there. I've got no doubt about it whatsoever. We can get to zero spread. Stop talking about elimination and eradication. It's just that we should have zero tolerance for spread and aim for zero. And we may not get quite to zero, but we should get closer. But this notion of suppression is about giving up and not setting clear targets, where the target should be not that there's no COVID-19 around, virus around, but there's zero spread. And we can get there. And most states have, and most states want, and certainly Victoria and New South Wales want to. And this is the problem with the bipartisanship, is that there's a degree of singing, this is the weakness of bipartisanship, is that you sing kumbaya to maintain unity when in fact you need some diversity of opinion and a bit of sandpaper here to polish up the arguments and get the right strategy moving forward. So I'm worried about recovery is that we're locked into this national consensus rather than strong sense of common ground that's stronger moving forward.
It's interesting, isn't it, that this is an area where there's much more significant contestation between scientists about the way forward, and essentially.
Well, if I can interrupt you there, there's almost no contesting amongst public health doctors and experts of this. The contesting comes from the advice the Commonwealth's getting from hospital-based infectious disease specialists, who are not public health doctors, and they're pretending to be. They're great people, all nice people. Very good if you want to control your methicillin-resistant staph, golden staph in the hospitals, and not too bad with the flu, but they're not experienced in this area, whereas the experience is actually on the ground at state level. So there's very little debate amongst the public health community here. It's just this coterie of people in Canberra advising the government who are not expert. They're great people in particular areas, but they're not particularly expert in this stage that we're at now.
But I guess a grown-up debate about public policy, as you said, is to allow for differences of opinion and ideas, because that's a reflection of high-quality public policy debate.
So this is the tension with COVID-19. Is that consistency of messaging in a pandemic is really important, as is transparency, as is trust. So the problem, so that you've got to tell the truth, you've got to tell it as it is, you've got to not, the American Centers for Disease Control has a pandemic manual. One whole chapter is on how you communicate and how you create trust. And we've largely followed that manual. Well, we eventually followed that manual. We didn't do it to begin with, but eventually we did, with a figurehead like Brendan Murphy, and giving consistent messaging. See, prior to that, he was making some serious mistakes. If you remember going back to February, I called it viral valium. Is essentially what they were doing. Both Greg Hunt and Brendan Murphy were saying, don't worry about this. This is a disease. You remember this? This is a disease that's mild for 85% of people get it. Don't panic. And you should have been panicking. And the community was panicking. And they had a major wobble through to the third week in March. And then they got their act together. So they've learned a lot through this. But it is about, so if what they are nervous about, I can understand it, is if you have too much debate, then the messaging gets lost because people say, and that's what happened at the third week in March. People were being told to socially distance, wash your hands, keep apart, etc. And the Prime Minister was off to the footy and West Australia was having a basketball match for 14,000 people. People said, and there was the Grand Prix, 250,000 people. Mm-hmm. People said, what's going on here? And that sort of debate is confusing and dishonest. So you've got to be careful what kind of debate you have when there's a national crisis on.
Yes,
I
agree with that. I think it's about sort of contiguousness. That each policy needs to fit on the end of the other policies in the chain. And so sometimes there may be things that are not in and of themselves particularly important, particularly pivotal in the overall messaging that the government gives. But things need to be consistent. So the examples Norman just spoke about there really undermined public confidence in the clarity of the overall situation. If it's okay to have schools open, or if it's okay to have three people sitting in a, you know, in each, six people in each row of a 737, it's still okay to get on the tram or the bus or whatever at the same time as you have to have all this distancing. These things, one thing undermines the other thing. And I think there was a fair degree of that. When the PM said that he was going to announce a ban of, any gatherings of more than 500 people. But in the meantime, I'm going to the footy, and so should you. I mean, that was the wrong message to take. And it was the wrong message again last weekend when the PM went to the footy without a mask, sitting in the stand, having a beer. Now, it was legal. I've written about this in the Canberra Times, actually. But it was perfectly legal within that jurisdiction to be doing that. But I think as a leader, you need to be accepting that you can do, as Norman said before, you do so much with rules, you know, there's hard and fast temporary lockdowns, travel bans and these sorts of things, stay-at-home orders. But the real heavy lifting in a pandemic is done by public buy-in, by public, by the community observance of the level of urgency that you have and keeping that level of urgency even when some of the other outward signs or symbols are about opening up. And I think what we're seeing happening in Victoria is that these two things, because they are inconsistent, the economy opening up while there has been no resolution of the basic problem of the virus, is why it is suddenly, it takes off, because there is this level of complacency that creeps in. So everything leaders do needs to be on the kind of, to put it bluntly, on the kind of extreme end of observance so as to be always sending that message. So the PM, if he was at that game, and I would argue he shouldn't have been at that game, because it was a purely discretionary thing. In fact, just before we recorded this podcast, Gladys Berejiklian said down the barrel of the camera, please limit your social activity. Please limit the things that you are doing. Now, you know, that was a good example. That should have been a message to the PM right there and then. You don't need to be at the footy, so don't be at the footy. And because you're the PM, wherever you are, perhaps you should have a mask on, even if you don't need it, because you're sending that message that, you know, that we are in extraordinary times. The crisis has not passed. The solution has not hoved into view. And as a result of that, you need to remember this is a different time and it requires ongoing vigilance.
So look, on a slightly different track, Norman, I mean, it is interesting the trust in television media and radio media has increased during the pandemic. How do you think the media has fared in its reporting of the pandemic?
I think the Australian media beats up on itself a lot, and you know, I do a bit of political reporting when I sit in for Fran on Radio National Breakfast, but mostly what I do is health and science reporting. And I, you know, we don't in Australia, when we talk about health and science reporting, ever sink, very, very rarely these days, sink to the depths of the tabloid press in the United States or the tabloid press in Britain. And certainly what happens in social media, we've got a pretty good standard of coverage. With people who've been intending to do that coverage for a long time. When I started off as a medical journalist, the medical round, and Chris and Michelle will remember, and Mark and Michelle will remember this, is the medical round was given to the cadet, and it was changed every three months. It was the least valued round. But now you've got people on major newspapers who've been doing it for years and really very good at it. And I think that's the foundation on which we've built. I mean, the Murdoch press has been quite oppressive during this period. I mean, I've been on the receiving end of that. And you can just understand it. You know, the Murdochs have spent three generations of their family building up a media empire. And as soon as there's a crisis, people depart from them and revert to Fairfax, and well, it's not Fairfax anymore, and the ABC as the trusted sources of information. And so there's that internal dynamic. Look, I just think we, without being complacent and without wanting to give us a herogram, the Australian media are better than we give ourselves credit for, and we've risen to it. And you know, just like the bushfires, and it's interesting that it follows straight on from the bushfires. So I can talk more about the ABC. There was a whole technology infrastructure that the ABC created for the bushfires, which just then moved on to COVID-19 and broadcasting from home and at a distance, and people just getting on with it and being very tuned to what was going on in the public domain. And when you look at particularly what the Nine Press has done, Age and Sydney Morning Herald, with their data journalism, it's been very impressive.
Mark, your views?
Well, I agree with that. I think Australian media's done pretty well. It's, as I said at the start, you know, this has been the main story. I think it's been, at one level, it's always a challenge to have so much focus on one area and just cover it day in, day out. I mean, you know, we've all heard people say this, we probably thought it ourselves at times that I don't want to read another thing about it, or I don't want to hear another COVID story today. But the truth is, this is the biggest human story probably of our lifetimes in a universal sense, you know, for humanity. So of course we're focusing on a lot. I think Australian media has done a pretty good job of it. You know, there has been this pressure from sections, the conservative sections of the media, you know, were sort of belittling this as if it was some sort of analog with the climate change debate, and that here was the same, essentially the same group, you know, the Academy, the ABC, you know, all the sort of lefty alarmists who were basically sort of telling the kind of, you know, the most extreme version of this, and that it was all a bit of a beat up. And that's very much, you know, Trump's line as well. We have a milder version of it in Australia, but we have some frankly pretty nutty people who have been saying those sort of things. But broadly speaking, I don't think they've had too much sway. I think it's quite interesting, for example, that Anastasia Palaszczuk in Queensland was... The suggestion was being made that she couldn't possibly keep the borders shut for any length of time because she was facing an election. Well, actually, what's been shown is that Queenslanders have embraced keeping that border shut for a long time because they've embraced the logic that it was shut for in the first place, which was that achieved a certain level of suppression, eradication, however you want to describe it, and they wanted to maintain it. And that became their primary objective. It's interesting. Everyone's concerned about keeping their jobs, but it's a secondary concern to keeping alive. I don't mean wish to say that they're not related, but I mean, you know, that was the primary concern as this thing took off, was that it was a lethal disease and people wanted their governments to take all necessary steps to address it. And that's part of, you know, going back to what we were saying before, it's part of the reason why I think trust and approval ratings in Australia have been so high, is because we've had a real-time comparison of a number of other countries to look at, and we felt like we're doing a lot better. The trouble is, we haven't got to the end, but we started to behave like we were at the end.
Yeah, my theory is that West Australia is practicing for secession.
let me hand back to Michelle.
They've got their way at last.
Yeah, almost. That's right.
Now, can we just look at the implications for democracy? Mark, do you expect that this whole experience will change the way we do democracy in the future?
Probably not. Going back to what I was saying a bit before, I think what we have seen is that voters do embrace a more collaborative model. They support it. They like to see problem solving. I mean, what do we have politicians for? We have them to solve problems. And politicians have been in problem-solving mode in 2020 in a way we haven't seen for years. And given, to use a term you used before, Michelle, given that we face some, you know, genuinely kind of wicked problems, or, you know, diabolical problems, things that have paralysed our polity in the past and threatened great danger to, you know, existential danger as well as danger to the economy, and I'm thinking of things like climate change. You know, we've seen how collaboration and cooperation can work. So it'd be nice to think that some residual elements of that will linger and will continue, along with what Norman said about the respect for expert opinion, the value of expertise. You know, I think we can be optimistic about both of those things continuing in some residual form. It's also going to be interesting to see how democracy itself works. And we've got an ACT election coming up, and we've got a Queensland election coming up this year. We're not sure which way this pandemic is going to go, but if things get worse and the situation in Victoria, we shouldn't gild the lily, is pretty damn worrying in terms of that exponential increase. Will that have implications for the way the elections are run? That's possible. It's certainly something that the Americans are grappling with at the moment. I heard a story the other day about literally pallet upon pallet of ballot papers being delivered in one state ahead of the presidential election, because they're expecting vast numbers of people to do postal voting. That'll be interesting to see whether it has any implications for voter turnout, even among other things. And I like to think that overall, we might have people generally across the community thinking about government a bit more than they were. The value of the state, the importance of government. When the chips are down, you turn to government. Maybe that holds some prospect for some democratic renewal, or at least for an appetite for beginning a conversation on democratic renewal, as Mark Evans and I have written about before. And, again, I might be naive here, but I'm hoping that is the case.
Norman, do you think, just going to another level of this, that this whole experience is changing our values? Will we become more or less caring as a society, for example?
I think it's hard to say because we're at the beginning. It feels as if we've been in this for 3 years and it's just 5 or 6 months, 7 months or so since it actually began. So it's too early to say, because I think that things could happen which make us angry as communities, which create fractures. So if it continues the way it's been going, I think that, yes, we probably could see more community cohesion and caring for each other and so on. But I think we've got a long way to run. So and with a long way to run, and remember what I said about looking into history, the history of pandemics is ugly when it comes to community, when it comes to prejudice, when it comes to blame, when it comes to finding victims. That's the history. Now, we're not condemned to repeat history. And so far, we've done okay. But it got ugly at the beginning for a while because it was seemed to be a Chinese epidemic, a Chinese infection. Trump is still feeling that. We are not feeling that here. In my office, there was a young Chinese-Australian woman, and born in Australia, and coming in from Chatswood on the train, people wouldn't sit next to her. This is back in February. And you saw hints of this with the hotel quarantine. The implication is that, these security guys can't possibly be Anglo. They must be some other ethnic group, and they've gone off and done, whatever, and a strong flavor of that. And so it becomes very easy to blame. So I think there are a lot of risks to community cohesion. And the one thing I want to add to, I couldn't possibly add too much to the internal democratic view, but I think there's an interesting discussion to be had about Australia's place in the world and the world order. Because one feature of this, and it has been largely because America has abandoned global leadership, is that it's been every country for themselves. This pandemic has been made worse directly because of the policies, the isolationist policies of the United States and the selfish policies. And that will continue to play out. And therefore, finding our place in the world, having to generate independent diplomacy, particularly as it relates to China, I think that's going to be a struggle. And knowing where we sit in the world and in terms of world democracies, because it's very fragile at the moment. And that will blow back to Australia in some shape or form.
Can I just make one very quick observation as well? It's maybe not strictly in this category, but we were talking before about changes that this crisis has sort of forced. It's really interesting to see the AFL, the Australian Football League, talking about where the grand final is going to be. Very briefly, the AFL is meant to be a national competition, except the truth is it's always been a Victorian. Yeah, that's right. It's always been a Victorian competition with interstate sides, and they even refer to those clubs as interstate clubs. And yet now, of course, they can't have the grand final in Melbourne. It's just a small example of how the crisis has suddenly just essentially broken down what was really just a cultural restriction, a cultural kind of barrier to change that has been shattered by this crisis. And so now they're talking about, will the grand final be in Perth or will it be in Adelaide? And they've got most of the clubs, based in Queensland. It's not a super important thing, but it's if you've been following that debate over years, the iron grip of Melbourne on the AFL has just been suddenly loosened for reasons that had nothing to do with football.
So look, a final question for both of you, so that we can go out on an optimistic note. Could you identify...
We're journalists. Journalists don't do optimism. What do you mean about that?
Yeah, but we do at Democracy 2025 because we want to celebrate Australian democracy as well. So what one positive development from COVID-19 would you identify where we are starting to see some real progress? Norman?
I think that I call it COVID-19 speed. I think Mark referred to it earlier. I think what we've seen is we create artificial barriers to change. And we've seen decision-making about problems that were thought to be intractable, impossible to solve, too many issues, that when people of sense and sensibility sit together and get away a bit from the bureaucracy and use the bureaucracy more as implementers rather than people who are risk averse, that you can move forward. And I think that one of the great things moving forward here is that we might move forward at COVID-19 speed.
Mark?
Oh, I agree with that. I think it's a really excellent observation. I wish I'd made it, actually. Let me make another one. I think it's been interesting in the way this has changed the way we view work. I don't think that's been all positive because, as I heard someone say the other day, work has bled into every day for a lot of us, those of us in the kind of information sector of the economy who are dealing with words, who spend our days sitting in front of computer screens. We find ourselves now at work a lot. But I do think there's been an absolute sort of shattering of the notion of time serving or of being at work just for the sake of being at work. Employers now are much more interested in the product they get out of it rather than someone simply sort of turning up at 9 and leaving at 5. And so there's been, again, this is one of those cases where, as Norman just put it, you know, there's sort of a cultural stricture on the understanding of work, which has really just been, dismantled at pace by this crisis. And people have found whole new ways to communicate, whole new ways to contribute, whole new ways to be in sort of virtual collaborative spaces. That's particularly interesting in the universities. As we would all know, it's got some real potential, I think, to continue. In fact, I think that is probably one of the things that I would be most confident about being durable beyond this, if there is indeed a period that you can usefully describe as beyond this.
So two big areas of potential progress there to the world of work and our ability to cut through on wicked problems. Well, we've come to the end of our time together. So many thanks to Norman, to Mark, and to Michelle for such a thought-provoking conversation. And many thanks to our digital partner content group for their support for this podcast series. Goodbye for now.
Bye.